Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
What's that one we can hear?
It's a buzzard.
No, the little bird.
That's a little bird. This one.
Yeah.
It's a chaffinch.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet. I'm Irene Quayle.
Before, I was able to herd partridge, yellowhammer, skylarks, bunting, linnet, and actually, we had only one skylark, one bunting. So the music of the nature is disappearing.
So what's happening to our birds? French songbirds are disappearing, Berlin's pigeons are thriving, and wetland birds all over the world are suffering from lead poisoning. As they say, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and what's bad for the birds is definitely bad news for us humans. Coming up on Living Planet. Now that's the kind of bird sound that's music to the ears of wildlife lovers. Israel's Hula Valley is one of the favourite resting spots for cranes, migrating every year between Europe and Africa and vice versa. Now that spring is finally here in the Northern Hemisphere, it's time for them to move on to their chosen breeding grounds. Ruby Russell has this report, filed from Northern Israel by Tim Asman.
The sound of breakfast time in the Hula Valley. It's early morning and dense flocks of cranes glide over gleaming waters, marshes and fields. There are so many of the great birds, they turn whole swathes of the sky black.
We don't know the exact number. Most of the cranes that we can see now spend the winter here. But there is the spring migration started, so there's a lot of cranes coming from Africa also. Our last count, there was 51,000 cranes here.
Inbar Rubin works for the Hula Nature Reserve in the far north of Israel. In the distance, you can just see the Golan Heights. The Sea of Galilee lies a few kilometres to the south. The Hula Valley consists of almost 180 square kilometres of marsh, canals, fields and an artificial lake. It's one of the world's biggest avian rest stops. Each year, around 500 million birds take a break here en route from Europe to Africa and back. But ever more cranes are staying put between October and February.
There is a special area that we put food for them, 8 to 10 ton corn a day. So we keep them in that area and there is not any damage to the farmers.
Before the reserve started feeding them, the birds helped themselves to peanut and maize crops. As long as the cranes are here, the Hula Valley is filled with their rasping cries. To the unaccustomed ear, it is a deafening and unchanging roar. But Inbar Rubin hears much more.
The communication is amazing. If you listen to them a lot, you can hear the different sounds for the different behaviors.
Just now, young cranes are on the hunt for a partner. The male birds dance and sing to attract a mate. Once successful, they'll pair up for life. But Inbar Rubin can already hear in their cries preparation for the next stage of their journey.
They are like a clock. They know when they have to go back north. First of all, they eat less. And there is the sound. They start to make other sound of migration.
Soon, the Hula cranes will be gone. They won't be back till fall. Inbar Rubin will miss them.
It's a little bit sad that they are going because, you know, we have 6 months that every morning and every evening and during the day we can hear them and now it's going to be quiet. I already do. They didn't left and I already do. Yeah, they are amazing.
Tim Asman sent us that report from Israel. Ruby Russell was the presenter. The cranes, like all migratory birds, will face a lot of hazards on their way to their breeding grounds, including hunters. Now, if you're a bird, you might not be too worried about what kind of shot or bullet kills you when you're hit. But when lead shot or bullets are used, it becomes a problem for the rest of us as well. Dr. Ruth Cromie is the head of ecosystem health for the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, an organisation based in the UK but dealing with wetland conservation all around the world. She was here in Bonn last week for a meeting held at the UN Convention on Migratory Species, or CMS, headquarters. The experts had gathered to work out how lead ammunition can be eliminated, firstly with regard to the hunting of wetland birds. First, I asked her why lead shot is a problem, not only for the unfortunate individuals that are hit directly.
As it leaves the gun, when you're thinking about lead shot, the majority of that shot then just goes into the environment. And when it's sitting there, it looks like maybe grit that birds pick up to grind up their food, or maybe little seeds. Maybe it looks like seeds. And so birds are very attracted to it, eat it, particularly water birds, and then they become poisoned by it when it's being ground down in their stomachs. And this causes really high mortality. We're talking about something like a million water birds alone that may die in Europe every single year because of this. But it's not just the shot going into the environment and being eaten directly. When you think about other ammunition, whether shot or bullets, literally going into the animals, then those animals can then be eaten by birds of prey, by scavengers and so on, and then they become poisoned. And of course, actually, it's this route that can then expose people who are eating game. If you're eating animals that have been shot with lead, it can even expose people to lead as well. We're dealing with a One Health issue, and the ammunition that's released into the environment, of course, that's contaminating soils as well, which will get into plants. So these tens of thousands of tons per year of lead that are going out, they are finding their way into all of us and soils and wildlife.
So it's not just that we're worried about birds actually being hunted, being shot, but at what that means for the environment in general.
Yes, absolutely. So when you think about hunting, you think, OK, you know, this is about killing animals and this can be very sustainable and so on. But if you're using lead ammunition, that you cannot argue that that is sustainable, because not only can it directly poison birds and kill them, it can have a much more subtle effect. Perhaps if they don't eat so much of the lead, we have, say, then what we would call a sublethal amount. And this can impact on breeding, and it can impact on their ability to fight off other diseases. You know, it affects the immune system and so on. So you've got this insidious poison which may make the birds more susceptible actually to being hunted or to being eaten by a predator. So you've just got this sort of noxious pollutant out there. And certainly from the research we have done, you can find very, very high levels of exposure to lead in wild populations, for example, of swans. When we think of something like Bewick swans, which come to Europe in the winter, so they are a threatened, you know, an endangered species which are declining. We know that one in four of those birds that we find at post-mortem examination have died of lead poisoning from the research that we've done. Very high levels of mortality.
So are there particular parts of the world where lead shot is causing problems?
I think wherever you get hunting and wherever you have vulnerable species that are likely to eat this, then you're going to have a problem. And of course, in Europe, we have high levels of hunting, but Europe is not alone in this. Certainly North America, you know, where there is a lot of hunting, and also, you know, maybe in African countries as well.
Now, you did mention already that lead is poisonous for all of us. It's poisonous for humans too. Should that not be reason enough to keep it out of the environment and to tackle this problem?
Well, I suppose because we've always come at this as being a wildlife problem, we now have, you know, decades and decades and decades of research and evidence on that. The human health side of this issue really has only started emerging in the last sort of 15 or maybe 20 years. Previously, we looked at groups of people, maybe subsistence, people who are, you know, dealing with shooting a lot of game, etc. But now, and particularly where game is more commonly eaten, and you know, you could argue that a lot of game is sustainable and so on, I think we're now much more aware of this issue. Much more research has been done, and a number of health agencies then have come out to warn of the risks of eating this, particularly if you're pregnant, or particular risks for children as well, because lead is a neurotoxin. It's particularly toxic there for where you have dividing brain cells.
Of course, the anti-hunting lobby would say the easiest way to stop it is just to reduce hunting.
Well, they would say that this is absolutely not an anti-hunting issue. This is an anti-poisoning issue. I think a lot of hunters have really recognised that lead is a problem. Now, the solution is non-toxic ammunition, which has been developed over the past few decades, and a lot of hunters have already moved to non-toxic ammunition.
What forms of ammunition would be less harmful to the environment in general?
The most common non-toxic shot is steel, and I say that it's most commonly used because it's the same price as lead, and a lot of hunters, not surprisingly, are interested in, you know, the economics of this. And so some countries like Denmark, the Netherlands and so on, they completely banned lead shot more than 20 years ago, and all of their hunters use non-toxic shot, mainly in the form of steel. There are other slightly more expensive non-toxic shots, which some hunters may want to use. And in terms of bullets, the non-toxic bullets tend to be made of copper and so on. So there's a growing range of possibilities of non-toxic ammunition. And I suppose what's been good is that the ammunition manufacturers, they have responded. But I suppose what the ammunition industry needs is it needs an absolute certainty of market so that they can then supply hunters with all hunting needs.
So how can that come about? What do we have to do?
I think this is an issue of sticks and carrots. So we can use carrots to persuade hunters to change, but it doesn't happen without the stick of policy. You know, currently the polluters are not paying for this. Currently the wildlife is paying, human health is paying and so on. So it needs policy to say we are going to get rid of lead ammunition. And that then gives a guaranteed market for the manufacturers. It makes the hunters know they have until this period of time to change. They can learn from other hunters that have already changed. And that is what is going to put an end to lead poisoning.
Now, presumably, we are here in Bonn at the CMS. That's the Bonn Convention on Protecting Migratory Species. As birds don't recognise borders, they fly here, there and everywhere, especially the migratory birds. It must be particularly important to get international cooperation on this.
I couldn't agree more. And what is so powerful then about the Convention on Migratory Species is that so many of the countries that these birds that are at risk are flying through are parties to the Convention on Migratory Species. And when we look to the African Eurasian Waterbird Agreement and the Convention on Migratory Species, they really have been leaders in pushing this issue, really getting political action. Certainly the African Eurasian Waterbird Agreement, more than 25 years ago, said we need to get rid of lead from wetlands. And then the Convention on Migratory Species more recently have said, actually, this needs to go everywhere.
When it comes to the consumers, we always want to know what we can do individually. Is there some way that we can exert pressure?
I think if you go to your butcher and you're wanting to buy game, I think ask the question. Ask the question when you're in a restaurant. I have to say, my husband has now taken to, whenever we are out eating, he always says to the waiter, how has this game been shot? You know, I would rather it didn't contain a potent neurotoxin, which I have to say, you know, it works well. Anyway, I think it's a perfectly sensible thing to do. Why would you want lead in your food?
Why, indeed. A good question for those hunters who use lead shot or bullets. Tens of thousand tons of lead ammunition are still sold in Europe alone every year. David Scullin is a senior conservation manager with FACE, which is the Federation of Associations for Hunting and Conservation in Europe. The group represents more than 7 million hunters in 36 European countries. I asked him for his position on the banning of lead shot, firstly in accordance with the International Agreement to Protect Wetland Birds, also known as AWA.
Well, FACE has a clear position on phasing out lead shot for hunting in wetlands. We've had this position for a number of years. And this is really recognizing that this phasing out is in line with the principle of wise and sustainable use. And it's also a position that really pushes our members to also work with their national governments to better implement the AWA agreement and phase out lead shot over wetlands. And that process has gone reasonably well, but we have a number of parties that have not yet phased out lead shot over wetlands.
And why is that? What is the problem about phasing out lead shot?
It's, I would say, multifaceted in some cases. Our members have actually called on national governments to phase out lead shot over wetlands. And then for one reason or another, it just hasn't been a priority for those governments. Wildlife ministries have many, many issues to deal with.
But there are alternatives available.
Yes, there are. We now have a number of countries that use steel completely, like Denmark, the Netherlands, part of Belgium, and they are in general satisfied with the alternatives, and they are also economically feasible. The same price, and in some cases cheaper than lead shot.
Now, we've been talking about wetlands. Does this only apply to wetlands?
The issue of lead poisoning is, it has been shown to be wider than wetlands. But our focus is, we have a clear position on phasing out lead shot over wetlands. But there are many, many debates within the hunting community about lead ammunition.
But I mean, we know that lead is highly poisonous. So should it not be in everybody's interests to keep lead out of hunting?
Yes, from many environmental NGOs' perspective, this is what they call for. Within the hunting community, the debate is much more mixed in that you have, for example, some alternatives for rifle bullets in the big calibers, but you don't have, you know, tested alternatives for many calibers of rifle, for example.
Would you be happy to eat game which had been shot using lead?
Yes, and I eat game frequently. There is advice now from several countries on how to manage game meat shot with lead ammunition. For example, the approach in Sweden, in their national food agency, they have clear recommendations on how to cut around the wound channel a certain distance to remove the game meat that is contaminated with lead. You also have some other advice on lead shot birds, in that you can remove parts of the meat that are, for example, bruised or contaminated by lead shot. It's generally a concern for pregnant women or younger children. So the advice is, you know, important in that context.
Hunter's representative, David Scallon. Well, in case that puts you off your Sunday roast, I asked Ruth Cromie if she's optimistic that we could soon see a ban on lead ammunition.
This is an issue with only one direction. Future generations are going to look back and think, why on earth did this take so long? So whilst I am optimistic, I'm also realistic, and I know that there are still hurdles to overcome, but we will definitely get there because it is a no-brainer.
That was Dr. Ruth Cromie from the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust. Both those experts were attending a meeting in Bonn of the UN-CMS Working Group on Preventing Bird Poisoning in accordance with the African Eurasian Migratory Water Bird Agreement, EWA. France has lost a third of its songbirds over the past 15 years. According to two studies, one published by the French Natural History Museum, the other by the French Scientific Research Institute, finches and larks, warblers and yellowhammers are all disappearing fast. For game birds like quail and partridge, the picture is even more alarming. The British and the Swedes have been carrying out careful studies since the 1960s and already knew their field bird populations were collapsing. This is the first time we have detailed information for France. John Laurenson travelled to the rural département of the Deux-Sèvres in western France to find out why this is happening.
Professional birdwatcher Alexis Martineau pricks up his ears like a spaniel that's heard something.
It's a listing point. During 5 minutes, we hear everything around us. Skylark, for example.
His observations are some of the thousands made by professional and amateur birdwatchers around the country that have been fed into the most detailed national study yet of the state of French bird life.
What's that one we can hear?
It's a buzzard.
No, the little bird.
That's a little bird. This one.
Yeah.
It's a chaffinch. Just here.
Before, I was able to herd partridge, yellowhammer, skylarks, bunting, linnet, and actually, we had only one skylark, one bunting. So The music of the nature is disappearing.
The main killer, according to the National Scientific Research Institute's Vincent Bretagnol, is the intensification of farming. It's destroying birds' habitats by grubbing up hedgerows and killing the insects they eat. 25 years ago, he set up a field bird counting programme that has made the Deux Sèvres bird population the closest studied in France.
Pesticides has a direct impact on insects, either through the use of insecticides, of course, which are used to kill insects, but also herbicides. Usually people do not think about herbicides, but herbicides kills weeds. Many insects feed on weeds or flowers, wild flowers. And the birds, actually in spring, all of these birds are feeding on insects, or at least they feed their young with insects. They can be granivorous or seed eaters in winter, but all of them, skylarks, partridges, many of the raptors, shrikes, all of them feed on insects. So a decrease of insects means a decrease of bird abundance.
A German study, whose results were published in Nature last autumn, found the population of flying insects had decreased by 75% in 30 years. There's no reason why the situation in France would be any better. Benoît Vigneault walking across some of his 1,000 acres. We're in a massive field of green wheat. He also grows rapeseed, peas, maize and sunflowers. He uses as little pesticide as he can, he tells me, and regularly loses part of his crops because of it. He doesn't deny any of the scientific evidence for declining insect and bird numbers, even if he is happy to point out the occasional bumblebee. But he doesn't think it's fair to single out the farmers for blame.
Est-ce qu'il n'y aurait pas un impact suite à l'urbanisation qui augmente de plus en plus?
Today I ask whether you have taken into account the threat from the rise in air traffic. Have you thought about the disturbance to birds of the increased light pollution from our cities? There has been a rise in the number of predators as well. The Montagu's harrier, for instance, is now a protected species. That's a good thing, but it preys on smaller birds. Then come the power cables, road traffic and, of course, urbanization. It is too easy to accuse the farmers and make out they are the only ones responsible.
Toujours l'agriculture, comme quoi c'est toujours eux les responsables de tout.
It's true in any case that the solutions put forward by the field bird population researchers mainly target agriculture. One that farmer Benoît Vigneault says he's put into place on his farm is leaving spaces in the middle of fields for larks to nest in. But top of the list for the Natural History Museum and the National Research Institute is banning more pesticides and encouraging more farms to go organic. In the meantime, the songbirds that birdwatchers like Alexis Martineau thrill to hear are steadily and surely dying out. John Lawrenson, DW in the Deux Sèvres, France.
Office buildings, hotels, noisy roads. The megacity of Berlin is developing so fast and so constantly, you might not expect birds to be on the agenda there. But DW's Tamsin Walker has made the acquaintance of someone who keeps birds of a very special variety in the heart of the German capital. This kind of bird is often maligned for dirtying city streets. They are no longer employed in the service of communication. Keeping them is looked on as quite old-fashioned, but that is just part of the charm for our Berlin nature lover.
There's a place I pass regularly, and yes, I am a creature of habit, where visual and acoustic poetry are hard at work. A small-scale 21st century Sinfonie der Großstadt, or Symphony of a Metropolis. Or at the very least, a movement, featuring nothing less than a chorus of pigeons and cranes, as in birds, and big tools. In a red wooden hut bearing the words Flying Tippler, in reference to the species inside, 50 or so birds coo to themselves, each other, and whoever happens to be passing by.
Come rein, come, get rein.
Their keeper, or fancier, as they are oddly yet officially called, is Bosnian Cemzo Enet Fekica, also known as Nico.
Ich habe immer geguckt an Tauben.
When he came to Germany in 1991, he carried with him a fascination for pigeons that he'd been nurturing since he was a boy. In the early days of reunification, he bought some birds and a hut, which he put down on what, until shortly beforehand, had served as the death strip dividing East and West Berlin. And they're still there, a tiny red loft where pigeons are bred to do things of which we Homo sapiens can but dream. Just meters behind it is another red construction, an elaborate makeshift archway to a whole different breed of dream. The wording on it reads, so inviting, so Berlin, so home, so Berlin. Yeah, you get the picture. The hard sell for hundreds of new flats and the unmistakable rhetoric of investors driving the German capital down avenues still in the making. When the site was first cleared, uprooting old fruit trees and a hard-fought battle with locals, I felt that familiar pang of nostalgia for the slower-paced Berlin, in which residents set up higgledy-piggledy bars, urban gardens and performance venues on disused space. The Berlin which investors had yet to colonise. All the more meaningful, then, that the pigeon loft is still there. It's a glimpse of the magical among the increasingly ordinary. For the birds, under Nico's guidance, are capable of incredible feats.
Ich habe deutsche Rekord bei mir.
In 2012, he and one of his pigeons broke the German record, and they still hold it. To be honest, hand on heart, ignorance on the table, I had no idea if flying tipplers were racing or homing pigeons. As it happens, they're neither.
Die fliegen nonstop oben, keine Pause. 20 Stunden 45 Minuten.
They're endurance birds, Nico told me, which means they fly around in the same general area for as long as their wings will carry them. One of his made it into the history books by circling the skies above its hut for 20 hours and 45 minutes, non-stop. And he narrowly missed out on the world record last month, but he's quietly hopeful for next year.
Come, get in.
To that end, every day after his shift working as a nurse for the elderly, he comes down to the Red Hut to train and tend the birds that have captivated him since those early days back in Bosnia. His tipplers know who he is and do exactly what his gentle whistles and whispers tell them to. I'm amazed that they can hear anything above the din of the building site, but clearly they can. Nico's pleasure is visible in his smile.
Ich konnte nicht ohne Tauben hier. Ja. Das ist,
I couldn't be without pigeons, he told me. Just watching them makes him happy. And as we sat on a small triangle of grass on that former death strip, Nico, every now and then casting his gaze upwards to one of his flock, the constructions rising up beside us, ceased to seem so singularly invasive, becoming instead just a bit part in this atonal 21st century movement of a metropolis.
Tamsin Walker reporting there from Berlin. And that just about brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. Our programme today was produced with the help of Ileana Giaducci and Thomas Schmidt. You can listen to Living Planet anytime on iTunes or on SoundCloud. You'll also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at DW Environment. I'm Irene Quayle. Until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now.
Single pigeon through the railings, did she throw you out? Sunday morning fight about Saturday night. Single seagull gliding over Regent's Park Canal. Do you need a pal for a minute or two? You do. Me too. Did she turn? left you out in the cold morning rain. Again, me too.